This is Rob Simone, and
welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight on The Joyner Report. Gosh, that was a good start. I really appreciate all of you being here. I see a lot of people in the chat room already. I'm not going to do the regular intro tonight because we have two wonderful guests, and I want to leave as much time for them as possible. Tonight we have Stan Romanek, and he claims that in September of 2001, aliens knocked on his door at 2:30 in the morning and woke him up. And then he also has been visited fairly regularly since. You all probably remember summer of 2008, that famous video that was released of the alien in the window. And I'll just tell you right now, when I saw that video, the alien looked so much what everybody said they looked like, that I just automatically assumed, well, you know, it's so clear, it can't be the real thing. And I didn't pay much attention to it, I'm sorry to say. And then I started talking a little bit more with Alejandro Rojas, and he's going to be on with us tonight as well. He is now a radio host for Open Minds Radio, a part of Open Minds Productions, where he is also a writer and research specialist. Now, before this, Alejandro was a spokesperson for the Mutual UFO Network, and that is how I met Alejandro. When the Stephenville stories broke, he was probably one of the first people that I spoke with when all of that was going on, because MUFON jumped in there and really got involved with the Stephenville sighting. Well, I didn't know that Alejandro and Stan were friends, and when that video came out, we were talking, and Alejandro said, no, I think you really need to pay more attention to this, because I know this man, I have been to his home, I know other researchers that have been to his home, and I've had some strange things happen, and so have they. So I thought, oh, wow, okay. Well, then I get into it a little bit more, and actually last March, Stan and his wonderful wife, Lisa, invited me to their home. I was unable to make it, but it was like, you know, if you really want to see the real deal, you come here and we'll show you everything we've got, and you might be surprised about what happens while you're here. So that was very intriguing. I was very sorry that I could not make that. I still hope to go at some time. I've also talked before I talked with Paula Harris, Nancy Talbot, several researchers, and they all believe there's really some meat to this story. So right now, I would really like to welcome Stan and Alejandro. And normally, I know we would start with Stan, but in this case, Alejandro, I would like to start with you, and you tell us how you met Stan Romanek.
Funny enough, Stan is the reason I joined MUFON. He probably might not remember this story, but when I was researching UFOs, you know, for a long time, even before I joined MUFON, like 7 years ago, I came across Stan's story, and I saw his UFO video. And a lot of people forget that, you know, up until recently, he had some of the best and still has some of the best UFO footage that he took back in 2001. And I always thought that footage was incredible, and I noticed that MUFON was investigating it. So that's how I found out that MUFON was headquartered in Lakewood. So eventually, through mutual friends in the community, you know, I got to meet Stan here and there. And then finally, Stan had, and Lisa asked if I could help them out, because this is really rough. Unfortunately, including MUFON researchers, they had gotten screwed over a lot. You know, people saw all of this weirdness happening around Stan, and they thought they could make a name for themselves and become rich and famous, and they tried to steal Stan's story and all of this craziness, and so they really messed him up. So Stan and Lisa, all by themselves, once an event would happen, would have to gather the physical evidence themselves. I mean, Stan, think of this, you know, waking up outside, you're bleeding, you're in your underwear, you have to get into your house. Once you get into your house, you've got to grab this camera and document, and then you call this scientist, and she tells you how to collect all this stuff for scientific research. You can imagine the amount of stress that these people were under. And so I was privileged, you know, to be able to be trusted enough to come in and help these guys out.
Well, that's, yeah, I would think so. I know that they've had some rough times, and really, Alejandro, you're the one that got me to pay attention to Stan's story, and I appreciate you doing that. And Stan, now I'm new to the Joyner Report.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay. Why don't you just tell us how this all started?
Well, you know, it probably started when I was a child, but you really don't think about things when you're a kid, and you don't really put two and two together until you're older. My real big first big experience happened in December of 2000, December 27th to be exact. I had met my wife online. She lived in Nebraska. I lived in Colorado. She had been to Colorado once. We were becoming very good friends, and, you know, I wanted her to come up and visit me, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm going to send her a care package. And I decided that the best way to do that is to videotape, you know, the surrounding mountains and, you know, the skyline of Denver. It was a beautiful winter day, about 12:30, and I decided I was going to go the back way up to the foothills. And as I was driving, I noticed there were about, I'd say 20 to 30 cars, maybe more, pulled off to the side of the road. And they looked to be, or seemed to be staring at something south above some power lines. And when I looked to see what they were looking at, I thought I was looking at some really bizarre-shaped hot air balloon about to crash into the power lines. As I got closer, I realized it was actually a metallic craft that was hovering, I'd say maybe 100 feet above the power lines. And as I got close to it, I noticed it started pacing my van, which scared the heck out of me. Now, back then, and Alejandro will tell you, everybody will tell you, I was really a serious skeptic. I did not believe in this stuff no matter what. And at first I thought, well, it's got to be some kind of government experiment, and I couldn't believe my eyes. And then I realized, well, hey, I got a camcorder with me. Nobody's going to believe that I saw this. I don't believe that I'm seeing this. So I got brave, and I pulled over to the side of the road, and I rolled down the window. And just about that time, whatever this thing was, honestly, it seemed to notice me, and it reorientated itself and literally shot to about 1,000 foot in a matter of a millisecond. Now, when I saw this happen, I can tell you that it just hit me like a bulldozer, that there's no way this could be anything we have military-wise, because if there was anything in this craft, when it did that, they would have been crushed instantly. And then suddenly it just stopped and kind of hovered there, and that's when it all started.
Well, and you've had continual visits, and it sounds like that even some production company people, I know this last show you did, ABC, that some of their staff members had some strange experiences. Can you tell us about what happened to the ABC crew?
Well, one big one in particular, I do talks. I don't know if I'm a professional speaker, but I speak about my experiences. And sometimes I do personal shows instead of conferences where I do a four-hour talk. And during that talk, I give like a 15-minute break after 2 hours. And one of the producers for Good Morning America, who was helping out with the primetime special, went to see my presentation. And during halftime, there must have been, oh, geez, Alejandro, do you remember? I think there were like 200 or 150 or something outside that saw about three UFOs just right above everybody, and they were one of them. And ever since then, she's been to the house. She's seen the, you know, we have all kinds of weird kind of paranormal stuff happen. The faucet turns on and off. Things move across the, you know, room. All kinds of crazy stuff.
Uh-huh. Now, the ABC crew, all of them witnessed these three UFOs.
The producer for Good Morning America did, and her friend did. They brought in other people from ABC to come down and film, and they experienced flashes of lights and all kinds of smaller things.
Strange. You're right.
What's different about my case, and I think Alejandro will attest to this, is the fact that a lot of the stuff that happens, most of the stuff recently that happens, only seems to happen when there's a lot of people around. So,
okay. Alejandro, what has happened to you when you've spent the night in Stan's home?
Well, yeah. The first night, you know, I with all of this, you know, whenever you're, you know, if you listen to Karen's show earlier with ghosts and stuff like that, you know, this stuff can be scary. So for me personally, I've done a lot of meditation to get over my fear. But staying at Stan's house the first night was pretty scary, and they kind of made fun of me because I had to sleep on the couch with the light on. Luckily, their cat was comforting me, but you know, we were hearing, this was the night after he had been taken, and there were noises on the roof, pounding, like literal pounding, almost like people were bowling on the roof. And we check it out. There's no one there. Sounds like somebody's throwing rocks at the windows, and there is no one there. And that was the first night. But being at his house several times later, you know, that, like you said, a lot of times when there are a lot of people around, something weird will happen. A couple times, you know, more than a few times, there have been UFOs that have been sighted when there's a lot of people around. I've been witness to one of those instances, and there are often, and you can see this on the video of that little creature in the window, you know, or whatever that is, there are flashes of light that come out of nowhere, and I've seen this. Especially up at this cabin we had all went to, where in the dark, you know, in the middle of nowhere, there are these extremely bright flashes of light, and it's incredible, you know, it's completely unexplainable.
Well, Alejandro, have you seen anything that you could actually say looked like an alien?
No, I personally have not.
But these bright flashes and odd sounds and things were very
bright
compelling.
Bright flashes and the UFO that I had seen. Now, I had the UFO I saw was, you know, one night we were out and there were all of a sudden a lot of what I would call satellites in the sky because they were moving in a single direction at a slow, steady pace. But it was strange. I've never seen so many one after another or a lot at a time. And then one of these that I was watching, you know, did like this J-hook maneuver and faded out. And certainly satellites don't do that.
Okay. Stan, this next question is for you. When I interviewed Stephen Greer, he told me that he had been to your home and that you had some very good videos. But this particular video that he looked at, he told you that is a programmed life form. And someone had been calling you saying that this wasn't the real deal, and you didn't understand that. And he explained it to me that he was telling you this is a programmed life form. I can tell by the way that it's moving. It's a mechanical type, robot type thing. Can you explain that?
Well, you know, I don't necessarily agree 100% with Stephen Greer. You know, he's an awesome guy.
Okay.
I mean, he really is doing a lot for the UFO field.
Well, was someone calling you, telling you this isn't the real thing? Or?
What happened was there was, you have to understand that Alien in the Window video is just one small thing of the stuff that I've had. I have. I mean, I have some incredible amounts of evidence. You know, trace evidence video. You know, surveillance. All kinds of crazy stuff. This was one of those instances where something was looking at us, looking at me through the sliding glass door, and it kind of blinked its eyes a few times, ducked down a little bit, and slowly went away. Now, what I don't agree with, Stephen Greer says that we manufactured these creatures. It does not make sense to me to, well, first of all, I don't believe we have the ability to manufacture a creature that can communicate telepathically, because that would mean the creature would be smarter than us. That would mean the creature can do things that we can't. Why would we manufacture something that's smarter than us that can probably... you know, control us and can talk in ways that we can't. It just doesn't make sense to me. Now, what happened was I videoed, I woke up in the middle of the, well, not middle of the night. I woke up about 12 o'clock. I was fixing my computer. My computer seems to get hacked into a lot. And I saw a naked figure running into the kitchen. Now, my stepson had some friends over, you know, for a sleepover, and I thought they were doing some kind of weird dare, and I was going to go, I was going to get my video camera and blackmail them, for, you know, use it for later use when they get older, and I couldn't, you know, I went upstairs, and they were all sleeping soundly in bed. Well, I was just about to shut off my camera when I see movement out of one of these, out of the sliding glass door in the, dining room, and I can tell you, it scared the heck out of me, and when I get scared, I cuss a lot. I should have, if I was smart, I should have approached it, but I was so petrified, I just sat there and cussed, and then slowly it went away, and I went between the kitchen and the dining room, and at the last time I went to the kitchen, there were five flashes of light, and I literally woke up on the ground 45 minutes later, not remembering what I had seen. All I remember were the flashes of lights. I had to actually look at the videotape to have any inkling of what happened. Now, months later, or years, a few years later, I went and showed this, and I showed this, you know, I don't like to show a lot of stuff on TV, but I showed this at my my conference, and suddenly I got a call, a mysterious call that says, you know, this isn't real, and blah, 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 blah. You know, I don't know if I believe that. I mean, if you watch this thing, I think it looks more realistic than the E.T. in the window. And I saw that little guy in the window. I saw him running away, and it scared the heck out of me. You can actually go watch this. Go see the E.T. in the window on my website. And my wife thinks it's the funniest thing because I jump around like a little girl and run away.
Well, it is scary. I mean, I think I would do the same thing. But I know that you've had a lot of controversy, and you've had even to the point where I was just shocked when I watched the ABC special with the picture of you being beaten. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. I've been beat up. A year ago I was shot at. I was told to shut up, and I was shot at. It barely missed my head.
Who told you to shut up?
Whoever doesn't want me to talk about this. Can I tell you who it is exactly? No, but I can tell you that our phones have been tapped. We've been followed. Our house is...
Well, do you think it's somebody in the government, or is it just your neighbors, people in the town that don't like the idea of...
It can't be my neighbors. This has been going on ever since my experience. Well, about 2 years after my experience has started, you know, our phones were being tapped, and, you know, we've been followed, black helicopters, you name it. I've got so much proof of this, it's unbelievable. And Well, I was living in Colorado Springs, and I lived fairly close to work. I was riding my bicycle to work, and some guys in a black unmarked SUV pulled up alongside me on the road, and they were at a stoplight, and they started yelling stuff at me, and I just thought, like, great, bunch of drunk soldiers or something, because there's a lot of military bases in that area. And I, you know, crossed the intersection and rode on to work, and I usually parked my bike in the back of the store where I was working. And mm-hmm. they had to have cased the joint, because they knew exactly how to get to the back of the store very quickly. There's a side road that not a lot of people knew about, and they cut me off, and the passenger, front passenger got out, and they said, you need to keep her mouth shut. And I said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't say anything to you. And then I heard them start talking about the UFO stuff, and it's like, and I told them, I said, you know, it's too late. I'm not going to stop. And I ended up with a broken wrist and a broken nose, and there were a lot of people that saw it, and the police came right away, and one of the guys I hit with a big chain and knocked him out, and then I got tased. And
well, what were their backgrounds, these people that beat you? Do you know? Where were they from? What were they, you know?
Well, I can tell you they looked military. They were a little bit different, though. You know, they had clean-pressed shirts and, you know, their...
But the police were there, so didn't the police get their names and that kind of thing?
No, they drove off. The police got there right after they left. People were calling it in as it was happening, and they'd seen one of the people tried to chase them, but they got away. And the police, when they did their investigation, they said there's, you know, it's some kind of professional thing, they thought, and there's nothing they could do about it, you know, other than, you know...
Well, you know, another aspect of this case, and this is, I think, has come up quite recently and caused you more grief, is this situation with the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force letter, where the word fallow, F-A-L-L-O-W, was used. And I have people in the chat room right now saying, ask him about the Air Force letter. People think he wrote it. So what can you say about that?
Yeah, well, I'm really upset about that because we don't know what to think about that. We had it analyzed. They told us it was real. The word fallow, there's so many people that misspell that word. It's unbelievable. My wife did some research. The head of MUFON right now, we don't get along. He lied so much about stuff. I don't know what he's
doing. Well, we might as well go ahead and say his name. That the national director of MUFON, James Carrion, started a blog back in August, I think, and one of his pieces that he put out talks about this letter. Isn't that right?
Yes, and you know, it's sad because that's the only thing he can use. There's nothing else he can. But he focuses on that stupid thing. Now, in this letter, this government letter, it talks about Project Romanek, and it talks about using HPM on the home, and it talks about, you know, that I'm going to have visitors. And it was mailed to me when I was in Colorado Springs. It's a woman's handwriting, which I don't have a woman's handwriting. And we never really released it. I'd show it every once in a while at my talks, but that's it. I asked John Schuessler retired from MUFON, you know, he was a good guy. They really helped me a lot. Ben Carrion mysteriously, I don't know how he got in. Some say CIA, some, who knows? I don't really care. But I asked him if MUFON would get involved, and they refused, which actually floored me. And now he's saying that he tried to get involved, but I refused, which is a total lie. I mean, there's...
Yeah, I saw that.
And,
Well, he says that they asked for the previous work done, and you wouldn't let them have it or something like that, wasn't
it? I was going to give them everything. They weren't interested. Absolutely weren't interested. And then... This document, we've had so many break-ins in our house. This document somehow, you know, must have been part of whoever broke in, but Carrion got a hold of it. And I wasn't, you know, just for our family safety and just in case this was real, I didn't want this document out. Because, first of all, I don't know if I trust it. Secondly, but if it is real, then the people that were trying to warn me, their lives might be in danger. And this idiot released it, you know?
And that's the reason you didn't release it?
The reason I didn't release it was because, number one, I don't know if I trusted it, because it did have a misspelled word. And I misspell that word all the time. So what? Who cares? A lot of people do. I'm dyslexic, severely dyslexic.
Fallow?
Yeah, fallow instead of follow. Well, the guy who looked at it says that government documents, they'll do that every once in a while. They'll put a number backwards or they'll misspell a word so they can track the document.
I had to be very careful of how I stated MUFON stance on Stan's case. But I certainly was not going to. They have the ability. James lives very close to Stan. All you have to do is spend a little bit of time with Stan, and you will have your own personal experiences. I've had a radio show where I had, you know, like a dozen or more people who I knew, many of these people I knew before they knew Stan, and they had their own experiences. One of these
researchers have looked at the case.
There have been, I don't know, as you know, if I put a list, I can't say exactly how many. I know especially ghost hunters are really good at staking out a house and spending some time. I don't think there's one ghost hunting group that's been out to Stan's house that hasn't gotten some crazy, extraordinary stuff, including a lot of strange EVPs and things like that. So there's been a lot of ghost researchers, because we have a lot of those in Colorado, you know, and there's been quite a few other researchers.
Yeah.
Okay. Are we talking about 100 people that have been there and experienced something paranormal or something to do with UFOs? Are we talking about 50 people, 100 people, 150? What do you think?
According to the MUFON researcher who investigated Stan's first sightings, he said he had found over 30 witnesses, and that's just his like second or third sighting. So certainly there have been easily over 50, most likely over 100 people.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of people. And like I said, Stan and his wonderful wife, Lisa, have given me an open invitation. I just can't seem to get there. But I do plan on going and seeing for myself. And I hope to do that as soon as possible. But listen, a lot of people have asked the question about the Alien in the Window film. There was an analysis done on it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact,
but that analysis hasn't been released?
No, it's been released. I mean, we talk about it all the time. I mean, you can. I've got
the guy who did it was on Larry King.
Okay.
Editors.
Yeah.
Okay.
That it was not edited, that it was in camera, the whole experience was in camera, and his professional opinion was that if that were a mechanical doll, it would have to be very elaborate because he saw muscle movement under the skin. He saw the eyes moving. He saw a lot of stuff that made him believe it probably wasn't a puppet.
Right. I mean, if it was something mechanical, it would have to be something like a Steven Spielberg production to come up with something like that, which would be mega bucks.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And Stan, you don't have mega bucks, do you?
I joke around. I always tell people I'm so poor I can't pay attention.
Me too. So, I knew that the analysis had been done on this film and that it had been considered credible. I wasn't sure, that the film itself was credible. I wasn't sure if they had determined, if it could have been something outside the window or something like that. But now, when you did that film, you weren't actually trying to video an alien. You thought that somebody was window peeping at your twin girls, correct?
Yes. Well, first of all, I want to let you know that most most of the people recently that we get to do any of the analyzing of the stuff that we have, we try really hard. I've tried really hard to stay in the, or out of the UFO groups because, you know, it's like talking in the choir. The researcher that used to help give this out to the scientists sometimes wouldn't tell them what they were looking for. And then when they realized what it was, you know, they'd be amazed. And this guy that analyzed the video didn't believe in UFOs. And I remember the guy who had...
He did or did not?
He did not. And,
well, what's his name?
I got a call from Jerry... Oh, gosh. I've totally drawn a blank. What's his name?
Jerry Roth.
Yeah.
Jerry who?
Roth.
Roberts?
Roth, R-O-T-H. He was on the Larry King when...
okay.
He was on Larry King with Jeff Beckman.
And did anybody else confirm his findings? I mean, did somebody take a second look?
Over, you know, we've had a few people look at my stuff. We had some people from MUFON in the beginning look at my stuff and say, oh, yeah, that's what it looks like. We had, I was on Entertainment Tonight, and a producer for Entertainment Tonight sent some of my video off to NASA, and NASA said, oh, my God, we don't know what this is.
Huh. Okay. So, you know, that sounds pretty convincing that enough people have looked at it and they don't find any photoshopping, any photo editing.
That's what was
they don't
unfortunate
see any
about the ABC.
That's
about
what's unfortunate about
the ABC special.
What?
That the ABC special that covered Stan recently, I don't know why, because I think we're all expecting this, that they would do an independent study to have someone look at the video. And they never did, and I found that incredible why they didn't do that, because it would have been great for the case. I mean, we're confident they would have came back with the same conclusion that the other professionals had, but they didn't do that.
Did they ever lead you to think they were going to do that?
Yeah, they told me that's what they were going to do. I got to tell you the story about that. That's really weird. The first person that ABC sent was a very seasoned producer. This woman had so many years behind her, and she was great. She got to experience all kinds of stuff when she was here, and she wanted to do the story right. And she went to ABC, the head of ABC, and said, look, we got to do this right. Suddenly, she mysteriously got fired. And then some other person took over. I think his name's Jim Boma. Jim Dupree. I don't remember what his name is, but he suddenly just switched the whole thing. It was so crazy. He didn't want to do any research on it. He didn't want to have the video analyzed. It's like, that's where the proof is. Why won't you analyze the video? And then, you know, they were here off and on for over a month. They're shooting, and they didn't use anything. And then they try to tell people that, you know, my first abduction was sleep paralysis when I wasn't asleep when it happened.
Right, and that's something that Joe Montalvo told us on my show the other night. Most abduction experiences happen when you're doing something mundane. They don't usually happen when you're asleep, but maybe when you're driving down the road or you're using a vacuum cleaner or something, you know, that you just... Huh? Hello? Uh-oh. Did I lose you guys?
Well, I'm here.
And I noticed that you said that first thing happened is when you were driving your car. But listen, can you tell us what is your latest experience? What's the last thing that happened to you?
These strange little kids are showing up at my house. Very bizarre.
Strange little kids?
Let me explain. During one of my experiences, and I lucked out, I got, every time I'm taken, I am taken with a woman. Almost every time, there's one time I wasn't, but I actually got to meet the woman just by coincidence.
A human?
Human woman, yes. And she's mm-hmm. now a really good friend of the family's. Weird how things work out, but, I remember that we were in this room, and they brought all these weird little kids in the rooms. One of, you know, a couple of them look kind of like me. Some of them look more alien than human. Some of them look more human. Mm-hmm. And I remember this a few years ago. I think it was like 2003 or whatever. Well, this last summer, I had my wife through a book launch party for my book, Messages. And we had a bunch of people over, and suddenly I was looking outside. It was about 9 o'clock at night, I think, 8 or 9, and there's this little girl in a gray jumpsuit staring at me at the end of the driveway. I'm thinking, why in the heck are the neighbor kids letting their kids out so late, and why is she just staring at me? I went outside to see what she wanted, and all of a sudden she ran away. Well, she showed up again. I went outside, and she kind of just disappeared, and I had my camera with me. I started taking pictures, and I caught a picture of her looking from, you know, out from behind a tree. Mm-hmm. Her eyes were not normal. Her eyes were very slanted, very big blue eyes, just bizarre looking. And it just went from there. Then another picture, I caught a little girl picking flowers in our backyard. And she was hiding behind her grill. And when I went out, I was taking pictures of the cats because they were doing some stupid stuff. She suddenly stood up and started running away. And I noticed she had a handful of flowers. I'm thinking, oh, man, my wife's going to get so mad. The neighbor kids are picking flowers. Well, when some friends came over, they noticed that there was a bouquet of flowers, a bunch of flowers laid on our doorstep. And then when I looked through the pictures of the cats, I captured a picture of her on one of the pictures. I mean, I got a picture of her on one of the pictures. And we don't know what that is, but it's bizarre.
Okay. Now, when you are abducted, you know, you say this woman is picked up with you. Is it the same type or the same species that's abducting you all the time? Do they always look like the same or different?
No. The first abduction experience I had where I answered the door when I was fully awake, I call them the possum people. They looked more human than anything. Big, huge, almond-shaped, wraparound eyes, but their irises were almost a day glow baby blue. I can't explain it any other way. Very different. There was a female and two males. You could tell she was a female because of her physique. I've also seen them with the little gray type, although to me they don't look gray. They're more kind of a taupe colored with a bluish tint to their skin. And one of the things that I remember specifically about the little gray guys, one of them got fairly close to me, and I saw at the corner of its eye, it looked like it had a handle or some kind of something sticking out of the corner of its eye, like it was wearing some kind of contact lens. So I'm wondering.
Well, so do you think these are different species?
I know they're different species. I've seen at least three different species in my experiences.
And when you're on, do you remember the ship, the inside of the ship, what it looked like?
I remember everything. There's pretty much, you know, when I look back, especially my first experience, I remember everything. And it's like, you know, I couldn't tell you if I was in a room or if I was in a cave or if I was in top of a skyscraper or if it was a UFO, but I can tell you the room was like nothing I'd ever seen before. There were no corners, no sharp edges. Everything was rounded. There was no freestanding furniture. It looked like things were molded out of, you know, the floor, out of the wall, and the lighting was really bizarre. And I remember the smells even.
What was the lighting like?
The light, you know those new cars with that bluish headlights, that really bizarre kind of headlights that they have out now on the new cars? The lighting was like that.
Right.
It was from everywhere. I don't remember ever seeing a light source. It's almost like the walls admitted light and the air itself admitted light.
And you feel like these aliens have performed experiments on you?
Oh, I know they have. I know they have.
Tell us what.
I get a lot of people that get upset with me and say, well, they're here to help us. It's like, well, how do you know that? You know, they take us against their will. But I do admit they've actually fixed my knee when I hurt torn anterior cruciate ligament in my knee, but they've done experiments where they took skin grafts off my back. Stuck implants.
So you woke up with these big places on your back that you didn't have when, you know, earlier?
Absolutely. I've had, lumps in my hip, and, a couple of years later, they took it out, the doctor took it out, and it was an implant. I've come back peeing blood, and I have a bloody nose most of the time.
You pee blood, and you have a bloody nose, and your underwear is on backwards. That's incredible. When you say a doctor removed an implant, do you have that in your possession, the implant?
The implant went to the researcher and the scientist, and they did all the necessary work on it, and I've got all the documentation for it and the pictures and everything, and somebody broke into the researcher's house and it disappeared.
Ah, but you do have the documentation.
Oh, you bet.
They couldn't determine what it was?
Well, they found tiny little gears in it and microscopic what looked like computer chips and all kinds of crazy stuff. And what's interesting is when we sent, when the implant was taken out, they put it in a test tube, and the researcher said, man, hide it because they end up disappearing for some reason. Well, I left it up to Lisa to hide it, and she hid it in the back of my radio, and I remember waking up in the middle of the night hearing this high-pitched squeal coming out of the back of the radio. And the next morning I told my wife, I told Lisa about it, and she goes, oh, no, the implant. So we opened the back of the radio, and the implant was blown into tiny little pieces. Well, we sent those pieces in a sterile container to the researcher, and by the time it got there, it had a teaspoonful of some kind of weird amino acid in it. It's its own amino acid. And then they sent it off to some researcher, I think at Cal Berkeley, and they're just amazed at all the stuff they...
Who was the researcher that it was stolen from?
I don't know if I can say.
Alejandro?
Alejandro knows who it is.
What's that? I told people in the chat already, and I don't think she'd mind.
Can you tell us?
It was Nancy Talbot. I'll say it.
Okay, it was Nancy Talbot was a researcher. So was it her partner that was analyzing it? I forget his name.
No, she sent it off. She sent it off. No, she doesn't really have partners. She just knows a lot of real top scientists. And she sent it off to a scientist at Cal Berkeley to look at it. And when she got it back, somebody had tampered with her computer and broke into her. Stole some stuff, I guess, from what I understand.
Okay. Well, that's unfortunate. Nancy is one of the ones that I talked to before I did this interview. And, I've talked to several people, and they certainly say, yes, there is something going on with Stan Romanek. Now, has it happened with your family, your wife or your children? Have they been taken?
You bet. Most recently, we had a trip up to a documentary filmmaker's cabin, and all of us ended up having missing time and being taken. My stepson, when I lived in, I got married and moved to Nebraska, and when we were living in Nebraska, he was taken and then started writing he wrote a weird equation on his wall when he was only, I think, 6 years old at the time.
And you've written equations.
I have. It's interesting because I remember during my abduction experiences, all these things got put into my head, these symbols. And when I went to my friend, my best friend, Mark, I was having a really hard time with this, and this is before I met Alejandro. He said, you need to go talk to somebody, and that's how MUFON, the old MUFON, got involved. And they had some really good researchers and some really good scientists. I don't know what happened to MUFON at now, but... they said, well, you should get regressed. It will help you deal with this better. So they conned me into it, and I got up enough nerve, and I actually went and had it done. And during my regression, I remembered these symbols, and the researcher or the hypnotherapist said, can you write them down? And I wrote this real long page of all these bizarre symbols in like 20, 30 seconds, something like that. And when I came out of the regression, everybody was sitting there with their mouth open. And I looked at this, and I just started bawling. I fell apart. And I was hoping it was just gibberish, but they sent it off to the scientist, and one of them was for an elemental structure of a chemical that we didn't have that they would invent 2 years later. Another one was for, all kinds of crazy stuff.
Well, that's really incredible, and it's stuff that you haven't studied, right?
Well, I have literally, I'm severely dyslexic. Alejandro will tell you, everybody will tell you. It's embarrassing. I have to ask my stepkids how to do long division, and it's just part of being dyslexic. And,
right, I'm a teacher, so I'm familiar with that.
You know, that's...
Dyslexia makes life very difficult. You know, hey,
and
we're down to about a minute. I'm going to have to break you. I don't want to cut you off. I'm going to have you back on, but we're down to about a minute. So I want you to tell people how to get your book, Messages.
You can go to my website if you want an autographed copy. I will autograph it if you can buy it from my website directly, or you can go to the website and go get it from Amazon or Llewellyn. Or anywhere in the world, pretty much, any bookstore you can get my book.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sorry to say that I haven't gotten it yet. I'm planning on getting it. I think your story is one that people should take notice of. And simply, one of the reasons I think so, Stan, is because so many people have told me, I went to his house, I had this very strange thing happen. And just like Alejandro has said, you know, he heard all of this, these loud noises, these bright flashes. So, it certainly seems like, you know, somebody is seeing you and your family out. Now, I'm still not really sure if you said your family was being taken or not. So, let's clear that up quick.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You all had missing time, you said.
Yes, and by the way, the invitation still stands. Whenever you can make it up, you're more than welcome to come up.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate that. I think you probably know that I chat on Facebook with Lisa sometimes, and I know she's been a wealth of support to you, and that it's been very, very trying time for you and your whole family. But, Alejandro, it's been great talking with you also. I appreciate you coming on to support Stan. I think he really has a friend in you, and I'm sure that you're going to help him get to the bottom of what's going on. Okay, guys, it's time to say goodnight. I appreciate everybody in the chat room and everyone listening. Until next week when we have Steve Allen on Friday night. Thanks a lot. Bye.
First of all, in the great state of New Orleans, everyone at WPRN 105.5 FM, and all my listeners worldwide and in the United States, it's Paul Richard Price here with the Prophecy Chronicles. And as you heard before the show aired, we played a song, a clip from God Only Knows the album by my guest tonight, Greg Xavier Volz. Now, for a good portion of his life, he's been, a major force in the Christian contemporary music genre. He was a member and lead vocalist for the group Petra. Later, he went on to a very successful solo career. And in a way, he's been a founding force in like groups like King's X as well as others. And tonight, I'd like to introduce Greg Volz. And Greg, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. You're out there in the mountains, and I'm in the desert, I guess you'd say. But, you know, that's a good place to be.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, you've been doing this music career, from what I understand, from what I've read on your dossier, pretty much since you were like 13 years old. And
yeah.
Oh, go ahead, please. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm with you. You're on the right page. I started young.
And you were a self-taught musician, from what I understand.
For the most part, I had an older brother who was a rock and roller in the 50s, which was an influence for me. At 16, his band, the Rockin' R's, were an American band, Dick Clark, and then he went on to work with a show band in Las Vegas, and they worked on the Ed Sullivan Show and Dean Martin Show, Hollywood Palace, all that stuff for years, so I had an influence in my life, but basically, you know, we just figured it out ourselves. We bought those Beatle books, and we learned to play the chords and went on from there.
Well, and you have a 4-octave range, if I'm correct.
Well, I guess you could say that. I have a real high voice. Still works good, and that's great, you know. And I've been known to sing low as well, but, you know, whatever, it works in between. And so whatever key you want to do it in, we can do it.
And what a lot of my listeners may not know about you, Greg, is the fact that you at one time had been offered, right after you became a Christian, by the way, the lead singer position after Kevin Cronin left for a short time, REO Speedwagon. What happened there?
Well, the interesting part of that actually goes back into the late 60s. I was with a band in Bloomington, Normal, Illinois. I was going to Illinois State University, and we had a band called Gideon's Bible, which was not a Christian group. And REO Speedwagon was in Champaign at the University of Illinois, and their manager was always trying to get me out of that group, out of my group, into one of his. And years later, when I was living in Missouri at the time, and they were doing an album at Golden Boy Studios in Pekin, Illinois, and there was a riff or something happened with the group, and Kevin just walked on them, and somebody asked the question, well, what are we going to do? Now, they're in the middle of recording a brand new album. And, you know, when your lead singer walks out in the middle of a new album, that's not a good thing. somebody said, well, you know, remember Volts. What about Volts? What's he's doing? And it turned out that the engineer at that studio had my phone number. They called me, middle of the night. And, I mean, it was a great invitation, but, you know, actually I'd been a Christian for 6 years at that point, and I just didn't think that I could sing the material, so I passed on it. And it was actually 6 weeks later that I got a call from Petra. They were in the same studio, and their manager saying, "Greg, you got to come help this man." And so I got on a plane the next morning, and the rest was history. So that was in '76, and officially left the group in the spring of '86.
So you were with the group for a total of 10 years before you decided to go solo.
Mm-hmm.
And during
yeah.
that, oh, go ahead, please.
No, I'm fine. I'm with you. I'm saying,
Well, and you had some great hits during that time, some really good inspirational songs, and I want to let my, pardon me, my listeners here know the fact that, you know, first of all, you know, I am a Christian. I do believe in God. And that came from a very low point in my life when I was younger, being a victim of child abuse and other things. And if it wasn't for the music that you performed, then you were one of the great influences on my life, Greg.
Hmm.
I probably would not have come to know the Lord the way I did.
Wow.
And I wanted to, you know, give you a, you know, heads up on that. And I want to know, you know, when you were younger, did you start off in a Christian family?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, I grew up Catholic, and I went to church 6 days a week, went to parochial school, started school every day with Mass, and I never got it. I never got it. I heard about Jesus all my life, but I never got it. And when I moved away, after I graduated from high school, moved away to go to college, and I was in bands the whole time. I mean, the Wombats started in 63. We really didn't sign our first recording contract until 65. That'd be 1965. And, you know, I got in college and it didn't make any sense. They changed the Mass from Latin to English. It was like, oh my gosh, this is boring. And, you know, I just basically went into the whole hippie drug culture thing. And, started studying Easter philosophy and became a vegetarian, if that makes any sense. But it was just a couple years after that that the whole band that I was with, they had an encounter with the Holy Spirit that just basically changed, I mean, it changed our lives. And so I've been singing gospel music since 1970, so that's 39 years. Well, yeah, 39 years, wow. And it's been a wild ride, but you know, the music that we did, it was not accepted. You know, we played rock and roll. It was like the Beatles meets the Vanilla Fudge meets Led Zeppelin meets, you know, whatever it was. We were a rockin' band. And this was before Petra. The group was called E, which is a small letter E. And wherever they let us set up, and we'd set up and play and tell people that God loved them, and things happened. You know, I mean, people came to the Lord by the thousands, and we call that, I think they called that the Jesus movement at the beginning of that. But, you know, it's been a wild ride. It's like I don't think that anyone that has an encounter with the Holy Spirit and is born again realizes what they're about to embark on. But when your life is drastically changed like mine was, people take note, I think, more. And the thing was, it was about love. Love was the answer that changed us. You know, it was a loving thing. We realized that God loved us in the midst of all of that stuff.
So you were one of the founders, or you were in the beginning of the Jesus movement back there,
yeah,
in the early days.
They called them pioneers. I guess we we didn't have any covered wagons, but we would have if they let us. You know, the whole vegetarian, you know, Eastern philosophy, have your own garden, love and peace and all that, except we didn't know who the author of peace was. You know, there's one scripture in the Bible that says that there's no peace without the Prince of Peace, which we know is the Lord Jesus Christ. But, I mean, it has to do with people's lives being changed in a way that they know that God's love is real, and they experience that love in such a way that they want to tell somebody about it, and then someone else's life is changed. And so, yeah, golly, what can I say? It's been an incredible journey.
Well, I mean, being that you were one of the pioneers in the movement, and then later you went to be at first a studio vocalist, if I'm correct, for Petra, and then later they just said, you know what?
Yeah, later that year, I started doing dates with him. But, I mean, to begin with, but of course, here's the story with Petra is that I knew the group from the very first day. The group that I told you about, E, was supposed to do this concert in Fort Wayne, Indiana at Coffee House. And the group had disbanded because our guitar player ended up with the Milwaukee Jesus people and said, you know, I can't come back to the band for a while. And so we shut it down, and we had this engagement booked. John Lloyd, the head there, says, well, he said, I'm not telling these people you're not coming, man. If you have to bring an acoustic guitar and come by yourself, you're coming. I said, well, that's probably what it's going to be. So I get there. Now, when I say coffee house, it's about 300 seats. It was a really good-sized coffee house. And so I get there, and he comes up to me, and he says, hey, Greg, I got these guys that are going to open for you. They've been going to this Bible school here at the church, and so they're really loud. And I said, well, so what's the deal? He said, well, they're starting a band. They said, well, what's it called? They said, well, they don't really know. They think they're going to call it, they said, Petra. So the very first concert Petra ever did, they opened for me. Isn't that a kick? At the end of the concert, you know, I'm standing talking to people, and the two guitar players, Bob and Greg, come up to me, and they say, hey, man, we want you to know we believe you're supposed to be our lead singer. Like one of those, God told us that you're supposed to be our lead singer. I said, really? I said, why do you believe that? And one of them looked, the other one said, well, we can't sing. I thought that was a pretty good answer. But so I said I'd pray about it. And it didn't work out at that time. I felt like that it wasn't the right time. E-Band got back together for a while. And then Petra recorded their first album. And then when they were right in the studio doing the second album, and they sent me tapes all the time saying, hey, here it is, you know, we still want you to be the singer all the time. They sent me tapes, but I never could do it until I felt, you know, in my heart I was released to do so. So when they were in working on Come and Join Us, I got a release in my spirit and literally got on a plane the next morning and went in there and jumped in. So later that year, you know, I think, I don't know what the first date was, they were doing, you know, back then there was no circuit. I mean, churches wouldn't let you in because we played rock and roll. I mean, we, like, played rock and roll. But we had a message about our faith. So the churches didn't know what to do with this. They thought we were, they would point their finger at you and tell you you were from the devil. And meanwhile, people's lives were being changed from the music and in the concerts. So I would go out and do 3-4, you know, dates in a row with them, and then a month later there'd be 2 or 3 dates here or there, but there was no Christian circuit or there was no Christian radio stations. I think maybe there might have been some Southern gospel. I didn't even know that existed. I didn't know what Southern gospel was. You know, I grew up on, you know, the Beatles and Roy Orbison and Everly Brothers and, you know, Blind Faith and Cream and, you know, all that. So it made perfect sense for me to play the style of music that I was comfortable with and share my faith through it. And it was amazing to see what happened during that those early years. And it's still happening, just in a different way.
Well, one thing I want to bring up, too, that I remember back when I first became a Christian back in 1987, and I remember a minister by the name of Bob Larson, who went around telling everybody that, you know, if you listen to Christian music, it is of the devil, and you should not be listening to Christian music.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, man, give me a break. I mean, you know, yeah, the song that Petra remade from Argent called God Gave Rock and Roll to You. You remember,
I
did the lead vocals on that.
Mm-hmm.
Was pretty telling to me because it's not so much, you know, where the music style came from. It's what the message is. And even a lot of people who are in churches now don't understand that a lot of the church music that we see now as hymns had their origins back in the bars back in the 1800s.
Yeah, the old bar drinking songs. John Wesley wrote a lot of those songs. You know, John Wesley, you know, the Just Shall Live by Faith, John Wesley? He wrote
yes.
A lot of those old songs, the Mighty Fortress Is Our God. They used to sling jugs to that, you know. You know? So what was the difference between taking what we had and what they did, other than the church being behind? But here's my take on this. You know, at first I didn't understand why the stone throwers were throwing stones at us, because it's just they didn't like the style, and I realized that later. But the thing that you have to come to realize is that when they would point their finger at us and say, well, that's the devil's music, or that's the devil created that, and then I searched the scriptures. There's nowhere in the scriptures that says that the devil ever had the power to create anything. He doesn't. All he does is pervert it. So, I mean, you can take a country style of music, and it could be used with good lyrics, or you could be used, you know, for raunchy things. It's not the music. It's the message that makes the difference.
Well, and
can I get an amen?
Wholeheartedly. Well, one thing I want to bring up as well is the fact that, you know, in the mid-80s, you know, you remember that you guys were actually a big influence on other Christian, even metal bands, like Stryper and all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that we were the forefront. We took a lot of hits at the beginning, but we had a real good, I'll call it a voice. His name is Mark Collinsworth, who was really our acting manager. And his whole thing was, you know, go into the marketplace, go to the high schools, then go to the civics, go to the arenas, go to the neutral places, and take the message and the music there, and you'll find that people will come in that have never had an experience with the Lord, and it'll happen during that time. So, I mean, it's a great tool for evangelism. But you know, the other part of it is it's a great tool for encouraging people, too, because as you probably know from listening to the old Petra stuff, it was full of scripture.
Yes, and, you know, speaking of the Petra stuff, one of my all-time favorite songs was Grave Robber.
I still sing it.
Okay, and, well, let me ask you, though. I mean, you basically quit Petra, and there was a lot of controversy as to why that occurred. Some people
why? Why? What occurred?
Your breakup with Petra back in '86.
Well, the band never broke up. I just left. I gave my notice because my family was falling apart. And I've been on the road, oh, probably the last 4 years I was with them, anywhere from 275 to 300 days a year. And it just wasn't, it wasn't working. I enjoyed all my years with them, but it was just one of those things that I had a choice to make, and I made it. So I introduced a friend of mine who was John Schlitt. I introduced him to the band, actually in '82. We were playing the Lincoln Theater, I think, in Lincoln, Illinois. And I know John and his wife, Darla, and I introduced him. And later, he was a good choice, you know. So for that, for whatever that is, now they went a little, their sound changed quite a bit when I left. But, you know, got a chance to go back 20 years later and do a little farewell reunion, farewell tour. And, you know, we may do it again sometime. You never know. You know, when you get old, you know, it's like, all these old guys, and I don't mean we're old, but, you know, after so many years, it's a reunion tour sounds pretty good.
Well, you know, I love that too as well.
Hey, Paul, we'll start a rumor. What do you say?
Hey, let's start a rumor, everybody. You know, Petra may be getting back together for their farewell tour number two. Did I say that?
Some kind of deal. It'd be fun. It was funny. After being gone for all those years, we got back together. Man, it was just like getting back on the bike. I mean, it was like Bob and I start talking about all the weird stuff that we went through on the road. You know, we have road stories. Make a good book, road stories. But whatever. You know, God only knows, brother. Hey, that'd be a good title for a cut, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think that cut's going to be playing within the next few minutes, actually.
Oh, look out, man.
Right now.
Yeah,
and,
by the way,
Oh, I'm sorry, John.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, John Schlitt, for everybody who may not know, it was the lead singer of Head East, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah.
You know, Save My Life, I'm Going Down for the Last Time, for classic rockers out there.
Mm-hmm.
And he later became a Christian. He was kicked out of Head East. That was the most stupid move they ever made. But it was good for, you know, Petra. Thank God for that. And he later became, he was with Petra how long before the farewell tour?
Well, I think about 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah.
That says a lot, and I'm pretty
sure. That's a lot of years, man.
Oh, yes. We have 3 minutes left to go before the airing of God Only Knows, the intro airing on my show of that wonderful song. Now 2 minutes, actually. But the one thing I want to bring up to people, I want you, within the next 2 minutes, to explain, if you would, you know, the style of the album and what this song is about.
Well, the interesting part about the song is that I wrote it 2 days before I went in the studio. It wasn't supposed to be on the album. And I'm sitting at my studio at the house, and all of a sudden I'm getting this song downloaded. And we always ask these questions, and some questions we ask there are just no answers to. And so I began to respond, I would say, well, you know, oh, God only knows about that one. Or God only knows this. And the truth is, a lot of questions we ask, God is the only one that knows. And it really talks about what's going to take place when this whole thing is over and said and done. Are we going to make it? You know? Are we going to make it into the arms of Jesus? Are we going to make it to heaven? You know? And so the question remains. And the answer, you know, would be God only knows.
Okay, and it should be about time. And we have 1 minute left, but it's around time, everybody. This is the intro right now on my show, the introduction of the new song and the title track from the album God Only Knows. And I need to make sure I space it out correctly. Well, here it is. God Only Knows.
God only knows, yeah. God only knows what it will take. Will I get to heaven for heaven's sake? God only knows what I will do. A man needs his faith to see him through. God only where I will go, it's up to hell, don't you know?
God only knows where I will be. He's made a place that's just for me.
God only knows. God only knows.
Welcome to the Prophecy Chronicles with your host, Paul Richard Price.
Okay, hello everybody out there in Radio Land. I'd like to thank everyone for still being here on the show and listening to my wonderful guest, Greg Volz, and listening to that wonderful tune, God Only Knows. And Greg, you know, tell me a little bit about your faith. Now, you said that you started off as being a Catholic. And what was that conversion process? And do you still have any of the old Catholic traditions you follow?
The truth is that when I was born again, I was with this whole band, which was called Gideon's Bible, and we had just were changing the group. We had a new bass player and new keyboard player coming in, and we just were changing the name of the group, and we were invited out to dinner, by a little German lady who met our drummer down where, somewhere in, down in Talbot Village in Indianapolis, a little artsy area. And she invited us all to dinner. Now, this band that I was with, we all lived together. There was a dozen of us. We lived in a seven-bedroom house. It was, you know, we were like real hippies, you know, like we had community. But when we went to that dinner engagement, a friend of hers, who actually he was a minister, he walked in the door, hung up his coat, and basically began to operate in a word of knowledge, which is one of the gifts of the Holy Spirit, and begin to tell us all about ourselves, you know, like a prophecy. And with every word that he spoke to us, he just zeroed in, you know, clear and clear on where we were and where he believed that we were going. And there was a presence in that room that was so strong, and I'll just put it this way, all I could do was begin to weep and just fall on my face. And I couldn't talk. I couldn't think. I just began to weep and realize that everybody else, all our friends, the band and roadies, they were all face down on the floor. Everybody was weeping because of the presence of God in that room. And when I say that, it was like a cleansing that just washes over you. And like the monkey came off our back, and there was instant deliverance, if I can say that, from the whole drug culture, from the whole everything. And this man held up the book and said, you know, this is the word. You want to know the truth? Jesus is the truth. You want to know the way? He is the way. You know, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And as it says in the book of John, no man comes to the Father except by him. Well, there went the guru, you know. So we basically came up from the Lord, from the floor, you know, into the Lord's presence as new creatures. I mean, like a new person. We were born again. And I get up and ask this guy, what are we supposed to do, man? We play rock and roll. And he looked at me and he said, well, play Jesus rock. Paul, there wasn't any such thing. I mean, there was no such thing, but that's what he heard in his head. And I believe the Lord spoke that to him and he spoke it to us. So we became a Jesus rock band, you know, probably the first Jesus rock band in the United States. And I wouldn't consider Larry Norman a Jesus rock man. Now, he was a Jesus guy, but I'm talking about Jesus rock. So so we just went out, and anywhere they'd let us set up and play, we'd set up, play, and draw a crowd and give our testimony and tell people about our faith in Jesus Christ. And people gave their heart to the Lord. They were born again. So we'd take them out, baptize them in horse troughs and ponds and wherever we could find water. We baptized over 2,000 the first year. I mean, it was the real deal, and we still lived together. We had all things in common. I mean, we would wake up in the morning. Whoever woke up first would go to the living room where all the equipment was set up, and they would begin to play the overture to 2001. You know, dun 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 dun. You know that deal, and on their instrument, whether it was the guitar player or the bass player or the keyboard player. Or the drummer, didn't matter. Wake up the rest of the house with that. That was the morning wake-up call. And then we would just all get up, all file into the living room, and we'd start playing. Most of the time we'd play 5 hours nonstop. We'd start jamming, and we wouldn't stop until, you know, afternoon, you know. And then we'd go out and play basketball in the backyard. I mean, it was a great time, and God did some great things. I mean, you know, God only knows, brother.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, you've been involved with bringing up other big-name artists, actually, and one that comes to mind right now is the band that is currently known as King's X. Now, will you tell my audience a little bit how that came about?
Well, I mean, it started this way. I was living in Springfield, Missouri. Petra was on one of their sabbaticals during the early years, man. I mean, it was like on and off. You know, the band didn't know if we were going to be together. Then they were together, they weren't together. I think we went through about 14 drummers in 3 years or something at one point. But and the dates were spotty. You know, so everybody worked jobs. We all worked, so we could go out and play, because that was our passion. So I'm in Springfield, and you probably heard of Phil Keaggy, right? I knew Phil Keaggy from back in, like, maybe 71, 72, back in Lovin' days with Scott Ross and those guys. You ever heard of those guys? That's another story, Lovin' up in Ithaca, New York, or Freeville, New York.
Well, and do you mind if I could interject something right here?
Sure.
If you don't mind. People who may have heard of the old man who died by the name of Jimi Hendrix,
mm-hmm.
you know who he said the greatest guitar player he ever knew was? Phil Keaggy.
He said that on Carson, yeah. I think.
Yes, and that's Phil Keaggy, and he's a Christian artist now. But,
so,
you know, we're, and, oh, please go ahead, I don't.
So the point is that... Phil had just moved to Kansas City. I was living in Springfield, Missouri. And I called him up, and I asked him, I said, so what are you doing? And he said, well, you know, I'm thinking about putting another band together. He said, well, where are you? I said, I'm in Springfield, Missouri. He said, my gosh, I'm about 3 hours away. Can me and Bernadette come down for the weekend? So I said, yeah, come on down. Come stay with us. And come down and sing a thing at the church, too. I was working with a church there. And so... In the midst of this, we're talking about putting together the band, and I had met Doug Finnick and Jerry Gaskell, who lived in Springfield, who I had been talking to them about putting them into Petra as a bass player and a drummer, because we were always going through musicians. And it turns out that my partner Bob had just found Mark Kelly and John Slick, the keyboard player, and a Jeff Boggs was the drummer they found that time, and said, hey, man, I met these guys. And so anyway, they ended up coming into Petra, but Petra wasn't doing any dates, so I went on the road with Phil Keaggy for 7 months and pulled Doug and Jerry in. And so I think Bruce Hibbert joined us on the first tour. So we had like five singers in the band, and we had a really good time. So then when that was over, you know, the guys are still in Springfield, and they were doing some club things, trying to put some stuff together. Kirk Henderson was the other guitar player, by the way. They had two really good guitar players. And they were called The Edge, was the name of the band, actually. And I just worked with them in some recordings and stuff, and just encouraged them and fed them and, you know, helped them to keep going, basically. And then they changed the name to King's X and got a deal with Atlantic. And so it's just kind of instrumental in help putting it together.
Well, and I'm going to get a little bit controversial here, if you don't mind. The particular thing is the subject, though, of how Christian artists, some have fallen. Admittedly so, even in the public domain. For one example, when Doug Pinnock admitted his sexual preference and lost his fan base within the Christian music realm, and also other people such as Michael English and others, you know, with their transgressions, it has actually had, and had for a while, a negative impact on Christian contemporary music. And for a man who was one of the founders, and I would say you were one of the pioneers of the genre, how do you see that playing out and its negative effect on, you know, the genre itself, actually?
You know, I don't think that I could be the one to even begin to judge that, because there's no one that I know in this whole world that's perfect. The only one that I know that I believe was perfect was the Lord himself. And because of what he did with his life and how he gave his life, he could make us perfect in our spirit. I don't think that we're ever going to be free from the way that, how do I say this, just, you know, we deal with the sin nature all the time. Now, I don't know why people make some decisions they make. I know why I made some of mine. And, you know, I haven't made great decisions all my life either. I've been through the school of hard knocks. I've been through some tough times. There were a couple years, about 14 years ago, that I was ready to just go in the whole towel and just say, you know what, now I never give up on God, don't get me wrong. I love God, I know that he loves me. But this whole religion thing just absolutely made me crazy. and the whole system of religion and what transpired, because in the beginning, I don't believe it was that way. And so I just learned to get up, take one more step, keep going. When I make a mistake, ask God to forgive me and go on and try not to do it again. And that's the best I can tell you. I believe that when Jesus said that he paid the price for our sin, that we can be clean from that sin because we receive that atonement that he made on Calvary. I believe that works. And in my life, you know, I'm in a good place today. I can't say that all my Christian life I was in a good place. You know, sometimes we get angry. Sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes we just want to give up. But I don't think that you can quit. I mean, where do you go to quit? So people that, you know, make mistakes, I don't think there's anybody out there that hadn't made mistakes. So I think whoever's without sin, let them throw the first stone. That's where I'm at on it.
Well, the reason why I bring that up is that we have a lot of people in the audience tonight who are not, who may not be Christians and who may not know what it is that we're talking about right now. And I want to share with them that being Christians does not mean that we're perfect. I mean, by golly, people, if we were perfect, any one of us, then if all of us were, let's say 90% of us, 99% of the population in the world was perfect and one wasn't, that Christ would have come down and died for that one soul.
That's what it says.
And the point is, though, we're not perfect. It says, no man's perfect, no, not one. And no, we're not trying to preach to you tonight, but what we're trying to do is to show you, you know, a different way of thinking. Trying to think about it this way, I mean, a lot of us have been imprisoned by a lot of things that's happened to us, guilt about it, and all. And through the faith and love of Jesus Christ, he wants to give us freedom. He wants us to be free indeed at last, of any worries, of any burdens. He wants to take that away from you and give you peace. And this is the point. I'm not into religion. I agree with you, Greg. I'm not into religion. But I am into following the way, the truth, and the life. And that's only through Jesus Christ.
I agree. I totally agree.
Well,
I mean, for my life, I can tell you that when I have been willing to say, I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep going forward. I'm going to change those things. If we're honest with ourselves, we know the areas where we lack. And if we will ask God to help us, he will give us strength to change. And we can make a difference. It'll make a difference not only in our life, but it can make a difference in the lives of the people around us. And, it's hard to say, hey, man, I have no idea what I was thinking there. I must have been insane. Well, that's part of that old nature, you know, the selfish nature versus the Christ nature. And so when Jesus Christ comes into your life, there's a new nature that's placed in you. And then there's a new thought pattern that develops. And it can be in the forefront. It can be in the preeminent. You can make the right decisions if you want to. And it's not always easy because, sometimes we just get mad about the way things are, and you can't do anything. Well, I'm just going to pray. I believe God answers prayer. He has mine. And I'm still going today. I still have a desire and a zeal to serve the Lord with my gift, I'll say, that he's given me. And that's that gift of music. It's his gift, actually, but he's given it to me as a steward. And I want to use it to tell people about my faith. And it's each one teach one. It may not be a huge platform. It may be, 12 like Jesus had. But the truth is, wherever God sends you, there's grace to be. And I've learned to flow in that. So, I just want the people that are listening tonight be encouraged. There's somebody out there that loves them, that the Lord loves them right where they are. And he can make a difference in your life. It's that simple. You just have to ask him. He's still saying today, come to me. Jesus is still saying, come. And it's just our pride that keeps us from coming to the Lord. So if you can lay that down, I guarantee you'll see a difference. There it is.
Well, one thing I need to let you know right now, Greg, is that we have 5 minutes left to go on the show. And
okay.
I want to give you the time to tell our listeners about your website, about your new album, about your old albums, and how they can go about getting those. Go ahead.
Well, you know, let's see. GregXvold.com is the website. That's the easiest way to get them. You can download the stuff a song at a time on iTunes, Rhapsody, blah, 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 you know, all the digital domains. God Only Knows is available on those. And if you want hard copies, you can get them straight through my site at gregexpos.com, and you can listen to the MP3s. But, you know, it's the music industry is changing so quickly that I venture to say that in 5 years that everything will be digitally downloaded. It'll just all be that way. There may be a few people that like to want to get them, but you know, you can burn your own stuff, download it and burn it. You can print up your own jackets, whatever you want to do. So it just depends what people want to do. But if you want these albums, the old stuff, there's some good old stuff. The River's Rising is a real good Christian rock album. So there's No Room in the Middle. The Exodus is a great Christian rock album. And God Only Knows is probably the best thing I've done in 20 years since the Exodus. And I'd encourage you to listen to some of those on the site. And drop me an email at greg@gregxfolds.com if you want, or the info at gregxfolds. You know, go to the site. It'll tell you where to go. But it's been a journey. So blessings to you, brother, and what you're doing, getting the word out.
Well, I try my best. And thank you for being on the show. And we have about 3 minutes left, and in that time, I want to encourage everybody to go check out my website at paulrichardprice.com. And, okay, one thing is that I want to make very clear that on any one of my shows, you will hear the truth. Whether or not you'll like it or not, you will hear the truth here. This is a no-lie zone. You will hear the truth. What you do with it is up to you. And what Greg shared with us tonight is the truth. And I want to thank you so very much, Greg. You have been an inspiration to me for over 20-plus years in my walk, in my faith. And more importantly, you've got one heck of a good voice. And is it true that I've heard that you're almost 60?
Oh, yeah. Is it true? Yeah, I'll be 60 in January. I feel like I'm about 40. Maybe 60 is the new 40, but I take good care of myself. You know, I have a blessed wife that loves me, and it's good to be loved. You know what I'm saying? And you know, God's good. I got some good years left. I got some good, and I got about 10 albums in my computer that I haven't even gotten to yet. So you'll be hearing from me again.
Well, and another thing I want to ask you, though, you were trying to hint that Petra may do a reunion tour.
We've been talking about it. Yes, we've been talking about it. It's a good possibility.
Hey, man, hey, you better send me tickets. And
if we come to Bozeman, Montana, what's the closest big city there? Billings?
Well, Billings is one. There's Bozeman. There's Missoula. There's Kalispell.
Missoula, yeah. Oh, golly. We used to do all those cities, man. We used to do all those high school auditoriums, you know, back in the early 80s. Oh,
well,
golly, that's fun stuff.
Okay, well, it's about time to go right now, and it's been great talking with you, Greg. You have been an inspiration to us all.
You have a great day, man.
You too, and thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
And good night, everyone. Remember, same bad time, same bad channel next week. God bless. You have a good evening.